This is our monthly lecture series, and I'm the president. And if you want to be, if you aren't on our email list and you would like to be on an email list, you can sign up. And there's an email list. Please print very clearly so we can get your email address. And we are going to have some. We have some books on sale over there by donation. We're at Smith, so everything is by donation. So please feel free to look at our books and get some if you'd like. Our website is westmassjoan.org. And tonight, as in all of our lectures, we do not have a bathroom break. So there is a bathroom right here if you need to go, but we'll just keep working for 2 hours. We have a bathroom break, and it takes 20 minutes for everybody. We are going to be recording tonight, so if you ask a question or say something that you do not want to have recorded, please say, please turn off the mic, and Chuck will turn off the mic. I want to thank my board and the volunteers. We have 3 volunteers who really help us. And if you have something specific that you can help us with, you think, please let me know. We can talk about how you might help. So there's also been we've had a 4-week film and discussion group using the Von Franz Way of the Dream film. It's been a 30-minute film and then a discussion. And that was at my house. And I think the group might continue. They're working on finding a place to do it. So if you're interested, is there anybody here who's been working on it? Dan? Are you kind of a point person here? Is anybody else here?
Judith.
I think Judith. Oh, I'm sorry. I can hear myself first. So if anybody is interested who hasn't attended the 4 weeks, could you take people's names if they wanted to get involved with that?
So,
Marie-Louise Von Franz.
Who?
Dan. Raise hands.
There he is.
So, The Way of Green is a Von Franz series of interviews with her. It's a wonderful film that we just discussed.
This is good.
So, let's see. How many people, there seem to be a lot of new faces here. How many people saw a flyer and came? Great. How many people saw it in the Gazette or one of the newspapers?
Sure.
Please turn off your cell phones. Thank you. Any other ways people heard about us? Have you heard about us from?
Just
found us on the internet. Great. We're on Facebook. Please like us on Facebook. That will help. Okay. And next in April, we're having Ellen Peck. Where are you there, Ellen? On Pity and Terror, the Use of Theater in the Ancient Asclepian Healing Process. You want to say a few words about that, Ellen?
I visited some of the places that are called Asclepians, particularly the one in Pergamon in Turkey, and I got very interested in how these healing centers work. Some of the parts of them, when you see them, they look like, you know, a current spa, but then they also had a dormitory where people slept, and they all had theaters attached to them, and so I got very interested in what is this complex all about, and how do they use dreams as part of the healing process, and how do they use theater? So I'm going to talk a little bit about what these places were like, and then talk about one particular play to give you an illustration. I'm going to talk about the Bacchae, which is a play by Euripides. It stars Dionysus himself, and it, I think, has a lot of contemporary relevance.
Okay, thank you. And would you please help us if you are in the hill towns? We can't get up to put up flyers, put them in cafes, co-ops, churches, schools, wherever. That would be very helpful for us. Also, after our lecture, we usually meet at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. The Mosaic on Masonic. Get that. Say that 5 times really fast. And we have a salon afterwards where we continue to talk about what happened or we get to know each other a little better. So feel free to come over and have a cup of tea. All right, so tonight you get to see Sarah Jackson again, your third lecture here on Age and Beauty. First you did art,
First female hero, I think, and then...
No, that was last year, first female hero.
How images help us understand dreams. I thought that was last year. Anyway.
Anyway, three of
them. Great feedback.
Thank you. And so we're Agent Beauty. So let me tell you a little bit about Sarah. She's a union analyst trained in New York. Graduated in 2013. She has a background, I should have the mic.
You are?
Background in visual art and art history. I'll practice projecting. She has a love of and involvement. In fact, she's on a horse farm now in New York. She came all the way from New York, not New York City, obviously, to be with us. And she has a private practice in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and Hillsdale, New York. And she's a great lover of animals and nature, and she's on a farm. She's spoken here twice before. She's done presented papers on beauty, on the feminine, female queer at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Cultural's annual conferences honoring James Hillman. James Hillman is one of your people. And she's lectured on Jung's paintings in the Red Book last year. In a conference, I'd like to hear more about this.
Yeah. Called the Scaly Creatures Conference.
Yeah.
Once again, the call.
It's a Red Book. It's funded by the New York Jung Association. Mm-hmm. So let's welcome Sarah.
Thank you. Let me know if the people in the back can hear. Yes? Good.
Can we turn these lights out, maybe? To see the screen
better? Well,
yeah, that's fine by me.
We need some light.
A little light in the front would be great.
Light.
Is that better?
Yes, better.
This painting that I used for the front start page and in the announcement also is a painting called La Vecchia by Giorgione, Renaissance painter, fabulous painter, and it's thought to be his mother, maybe. The inscription there says quote tempo, on time, about time. So after proposing a talk on this subject last year, I decided I had nothing to say at all about it, and it terrified me, and I promptly put it out of my mind, and every time I would think of it again, I would think, oh, I still have nothing to say about that at all. I don't know why I thought it up, and it went on like that for some time until finally I got a reminder that it was time to really face up to it. So I'm glad to be here in this attempt to do that. And as always, it's a great excuse to put together some amazing images. And this is a portrait of an old woman by Guido Reni, another Italian Renaissance painter whom I love. So my central interest for a while, I have a background as a painter and in art history, and I love to look at paintings. That's my favorite thing to do. And so I've been interested in trying to write about beauty from the point of view of aesthetics, not the beauty industry and not about women, except the interest in female heroes sort of precedes this. But anyway, lately I've been trying to think and write about beauty, but assiduously ignoring anything having to do with beauty and women and, in the industry of beauty or cosmetics, the cosmos of cosmetics, anything like that, I've tried to steer away from. And pretty happily, for the most part, in my life, you know, also trying not to pay too much attention to that and to how aging impacts that for women. But it's inescapable. It's happening to me. It's happening to my friends. And so one begins to think about it. And that's where, in this topic, even though as soon as I proposed it, I got frightened of it, it's really a place where beauty and aesthetics come together with beauty in terms of appearance and how we present ourselves and display ourselves in the world, especially, I think, still especially for women. So eventually and inexorably, it seemed, even though I was trying to ignore it, art and aesthetics has met up with beauty as it applies to women, and that's how this topic arose. So a logical place to begin, really, is where the definition. Well, what are we talking about when we talk about beauty? This is a sculpture by Louise Bourgeois. She did it when she was, a model for it when she was 95. And 30 copies, 30, it's like an edition, 30 fabrications of it were made. And it's, I forget how many feet tall. As you can see, it's very large. It's called Mother. Louise Bourgeois. And the title is Mother. So in my view, the whole point of art is to continually redefine beauty. So the typical definition that, you know, comes right up if you look it up in a dictionary or on an online dictionary is this. That the first definition is that it's a combination of qualities such as shape, color, or form that pleases the aesthetic senses, especially the sight. But right away, the first example they give, I was struck by her beauty. So women, bang, they come right into it. And then the second part, a combination of qualities that pleases the intellect or moral sense. So that seems to me standard but really inadequate because, and then right away it goes back again to denoting something intending to make a woman more attractive, as in beauty products, beauty treatment. So it's the two are brought together more quickly than I'm comfortable with, certainly. But the other problem with this definition is that pleasing, you know, we do think of beauty as something that pleases us, that delights us. But beauty in art often does not. Right. And, you know, like this piece, you know, it arrests. You might find it ugly. Of course, a lot of art, modern art, is not exactly beautiful. But if it interests us and we stay with it, our sense of beauty gets expanded and catches up to it, or it teaches us something new, or it our sense of beauty, what is beautiful, evolves, and art is what helps us to do that. So, this is a photographer who's done a project of posing as figures in famous paintings and photographing herself. And she's 65. So age may increase wisdom and acceptance, but it, of course, diminishes vitality and strength and acuity. And physical beauty, we have to admit, takes a hit and falters and flounders and fails and ultimately abandons us. And this affects men and women alike, but women, who are arguably more identified with beauty in personal terms to begin with, we feel its decrease and its demise more keenly, whether we want to or don't, I think. This is a detail of a Rembrandt painting of an old woman. My question is, what can grow and develop in its place? We can't, you know, beauty sort of failing us to whatever extent we had any connection to it to begin with. What can take its place? My premise, my conviction, is that this transition away from identification with beauty can bring about an increased awareness, perception and appreciation of beauty in others and in the world around us. And I meant to say to begin with, if you have a quick question or a comment, you know, or a remark, shout it out. Feel free to interrupt me. I'll take questions at the end, and if we have time, we'll have a little experiential component to this also. Discussion along the way is welcome also. And I'm not going to go on for an hour and a half. That's the other thing. It'll be a little shorter than that, I think. So I believe that increased sensitivity to beauty leads to a kind of translucence or transparency in oneself, and that we can become better able, when we're not focused on ourselves and how we appear, we can better focus on listening, perceiving, accepting, understanding, and loving, which reveals inherent beauty in things and places. And that relates to Keats's concept of negative capability, which I'll talk about in a minute. So this increased openness to beauty also brings with it an increased concern and responsibility for the well-being and continuity of life on this planet, not just our own. I think we're incredibly anthropocentric as a species at this stage in the game, and we need to move away from that. We need to relate to, be sensitive and appreciative of beauty as it's presented by a myriad plant and animal species who live here with us, so many of which and of whom are endangered and facing extinction, half of all species, it is thought, by the end of this century. So, also, we focus, and when we're focused on beauty, we become more concerned for objects and places and activities where beauty is found and made, which are also, many of them, endangered, as by ISIS, ISIL at the moment, threatening the antiquities, destroying antiquities in Palmyra, and those amazing Buddhas that were bombed and so forth some years back. James Hillman, my great mentor, I only really was able to study with him for a brief time, but he continues on his ideas to be very important to me. He was one of the founders of archetypal psychology, which is an important offshoot of Jungian psychology and very much a companion to it. Hillman points out in a wonderful talk that you can find online, it's also published in book form, that the obligation, the sense of obligation to conserve and protect nature won't take hold properly simply out of concern and a sense of responsibility. It has to be prompted by love. And Hillman said, beauty makes us fall in love. It's as simple as that. And if when we fall in love, we care, we want to care for, take care of, or feel responsible for the object or objects of our love. And that's what we, in his view, need to do, is to become more open to falling and continuously falling in love with the places and things and creatures of this world. Now, we do love old things and old places and find great beauty in them. And that's frequently been observed, that, you know, old things are, age makes things more beautiful. An Egyptian facade, old tools, old American tools, old manuscripts, and those are paving stones in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem that are really amazing. Also, old trees are extraordinary, and this is the oldest tree in Crete. I lived in Crete for a half a year, and the olive trees that I spent time painting and drawing and sitting with there were over 1,000 years old and still bearing olives, and still those olives being made into olive oil. This tree, which was not in my neighborhood, is thought to be 2,000 to 3,000 years old, and it's one of the 10 oldest trees in the world. It's in a place called Vouvos on Crete. But when it comes to beauty in women and men, we really venerate youth. We're a youth-centered culture, and youthful archetypes permeate our art and our films and our television, and why not? You know, we love to look at them. Both the hero and the puer, the archetype of the eternal youth, both boy and girl, cross-gender lines, female heroes, which I've written and talked about quite a bit, and female and androgynous puers abound, and alongside their more recognizably male counterparts. That archer on the upper right, the ancient Greek one, is on the island of Aegina, which is another place I lived for a short time. And that's Artemis, the hunter, in a Roman copy of a Greek sculpture, and that's Jennifer Lawrence in Hunger Games, doing a kind of Artemis character, which she did really beautifully. And these days we also seem to venerate not only the heroes and the puers, but also the maidens and seductresses and the whole gamut of youthful female archetypes from Madonna to whore that seem to be fully occupied and overlap. And I thought that this is, of course, Beyoncé at the Grammys a few weeks ago, and that she did just this incredible mashup of archetypes, all rolled into one. You know, great mother, Madonna, she's pregnant, she's dancing around half naked like a, you know, a sort of sacred prostitute, and all of her backup dancer singers were pregnant as well. It was just kind of an incredible spectacle, and it's all gold and sparkles, and I just thought, wow, you know, she really rolled a lot of several archetypes all into one there. It was pretty amazing. And fun to watch in a sort of weird way, but we love to look at, like, as every culture has since the beginning of time. This is also from Crete. You can tell I have a kind of allegiance to Greece and to Crete, where I lived. This is, you know, we love to look at young people, athletes, performers, musicians, dancers, doing amazing things. And this is from 1450 BC. It's a wall painting in the palace at Knossos in Crete. Not just women on display, but of course young men as well. And this was a sport, a kind of ritualized sport of bull jumping done by acrobats. They don't totally understand what was going on, but it's still being reenacted in other contexts. This is in Spain, contemporary bull jumpers.
What does he do? Does he jump over the bull, or is he on the bull and jumps off?
I don't know. I don't even know if this was a bull at a bull fight, or if this is entertainment that's going on now as bullfights are being shut down and criticized, rightfully so. Perhaps this is what's replacing it. I didn't do research. I just love the image. Yeah. And it's so astoundingly close to the other ancient image. Yeah. So, by contrast, we have here on the right the amazing Goya painting of Cronos, Saturn, age. Cronos devouring his children, that's what he did. Until Zeus tricked him with the help of Gaia, Cronos' wife, Zeus' mother, and got him to swallow a big stone, and then he regurgitated all the children, luckily still alive. So that's, at least in Greek pantheon, the Senex represents the aging masculine. In his positive aspect, he's the wise old man, as on the left, in this Chinese painting of Lao Tse, the philosopher, embodying discernment and judgment, coming from long experience. But in his negative aspect, as in Cronos or Saturn, he represents time in a devouring sense, critical, constricting, contracted, threatened, and threatening. And the Senex is also part of a polarity of puer and senex. Hillman always reminds us, and Jung too, that they can't be taken apart but need to be considered together, and that they're not just tied to our chronological aging process. You can have a senex attitude or a puer attitude at any time in your lifespan. There are some young people who have a very wise old quality and or can be going through a wise old phase and then come out of it into a much more youthful stage, and so on and so on.
I'm not familiar with that term.
Senex. It means wise old men. Well, of course, what about wise old women? So that's where we're headed, right? Senex is talked about a lot by Jung and by Hillman also, but the wise old woman, not as much. You know, interestingly, it's one of the places where the inherent sexism of, you know, that's in our tradition unfortunately comes out and needs to be is being transformed. So where I'm going with this is I start looking for images of wise old women, of the positive aspect of aging, especially for women, not just for men. And what do you know? There aren't very many, especially for somebody who's Hellenically focused as I am.
Right.
And it really points to the deficit of that Greek-Roman orientation that's been in our education system for so long. You know, it's a European
right.
focus that, you know, has Greek, Roman Greece as its foundation, where there are not very many wise women figures, so one has to, as Pinkola Estes and other great Jungians and other people have broadened their scope.
So question over here, comment.
Yes.
Yeah, in 6 or 7 years of Latin, I don't ever remember hearing Senex translated wise old man, just old man.
Old man, okay. Jung uses it.
I'm trying to alleviate the slant a little bit.
Thank you, yes. It's true. But Jung uses it to refer to the archetype of the wise old man. So I think that's where it came into my parlance.
Okay, so does he have a parallel Latin term for wise old man?
No, he does not.
And then related to that, I remember thinking about Harry Potter, the witches and the wizards, and I looked this all up, and a wizard is a wise man. And I do not think there is a term in English for the wise woman, which is not the complementary.
Professor McGonagall is coming. coming, you know, just come in.
I
see the great figure. No, but that's a good point.
What about the word crone, though?
We're going to come to that in a second, too. Yes. I think it has largely negative connotations.
The root is carrion.
Carrion.
Yeah.
Even though it sounds sort of like chronos.
Yes.
Yes.
But
yep.
It's
very negative.
Flesh.
Great. Okay, so in looking in the Greek pantheon for wise old women or any old women figures, the only one who shows up is a wonderful figure, Baubo. The bottom three images are Baubo. And that name in Greek may actually mean vulva or have meant vulva in ancient Greece. Anyway, it's disputed whether or not she was actually a god or a goddess or this sort of semi-divine figure. But she was a nursemaid, and the old women who show up in Greek art are usually nursemaids. She was a nursemaid to the Demeter's little son Iacos when Persephone had been grabbed and taken to the underworld by Hades, and Demeter was in mourning, and she began to put the world into permanent winter. As the myth goes, she just wouldn't cheer up. She wouldn't snap out of it, and Baubo was trying to cheer her up, and Baubo always had no underwear under her long skirt. So she hid little Iacos under her skirt, and then came to Demeter and flung her skirt up, exposing not only the little boy but her genitals as well, and made Demeter laugh. And it was the first time that Demeter laughed after Persephone was abducted. So that's about it for wise and funny old women in Greek mythology. But Baubo is a wonderful kind of figure. And but in Norse mythology, on the upper right, in one account, there's Snorri Sturluson, who wrote the Prose Edda, which is one of the ancient Icelandic sagas in the 13th century. He told a story about another old lady, kind of nursemaid sort of figure, Elli, who turned out to be gigantically powerful, and she got into a wrestling match with Thor and beat him. So that's Ellie on the upper right. And these are a couple of Native American masks. Of course, Native American folklore and mythology is full of wise old women figures. So it's hard to find images of them, though. They don't seem to be well depicted in Native American art that I could find, at least in museums online. But I should do more research in trying to find images of them. So Grandmother Woodchuck is one of the wise old women in Native American lore. She's the grandmother of the hero Glooskap, and he makes dumb mistakes, which she helps him to correct. She shows up in Abenaki, Penobscot, Maliseet, and Passamaquoddy tales. She's also related to the Mi'kmaq character of Nokomis, and to the Anishinaabe Nokomi, and to the Wampanoag Squant. Those are all wise old woodchuck-like grandmother figures. And they are shapeshifters, so they can go into their animal aspect or their human aspect. There are also tales, Native American tales, about old fox lady and grandmother fox, and that's in the Cree and the Ojibwe traditions. In Japanese folk tales, there's a fox lady also. I don't think she's particularly old, but she's very wise, and she partakes of a trickster quality as well. And here she is in a beautiful woodcut by Kuniyoshi from the 17th century, and her animal aspect is being projected onto a screen. Her little son is asleep there, and when he wakes up or dreams, he can see her fox aspect projected. So coming back to the crone and to Hecate, you know, people think of Hecate in Greek mythology as being a crone figure, but actually she's a light bearer and she's a tripartite, a three-headed figure. She's not old. She's not depicted as old. So the association with witches and crones came later on. She carries torches, and she's often accompanied by... So she's associated with nighttime and the moon, and she's accompanied by dogs, and dogs and horses as well. So she's a great figure, a powerful figure. She makes... she's like a witch predecessor to... European and American witches, in that she was a maker of herbal medicines and poisons, and carried torches and keys, and was had her own temples and was worshipped and given her due in Greek culture and in Roman culture as well. Quite positive, but when it came into medieval Europe, I couldn't resist that cartoon. God's pet. But this is Goya on the left, and that's a witch, an old witch with a young witch in training on the broomstick. And there's apparently a double entendre there, because the owl in Spanish, I don't know the word, but it was in Goya's time, the word that was also a euphemism for a prostitute, so witches were thought to be corrupting, older witches corrupting young women and bringing them into prostitution, selling themselves and profiting from that and so on. And so very negative connotations, as we know, were attached to European medieval witches, and from then on they were persecuted, of course, and viewed very unfairly. And I think that some of that stigma, which is attached to the crone and to the old woman, has a kind of archetypal connection, hooks up with the witch, archetypally. So, you know, they were healers, curanderas, but then they got this negative valence because of religious views and so on.
Yeah.
And just because of... as matriarchies were squashed, the power in the witch was threatening and had to be repressed. So the positive figures, wise women, wise old women figures, who we do have in our culture, in our popular culture, the positive nature of the witch, when is carried by fairy godmothers, grandmothers in fairy tales, and most recently in the Harry Potter books and movies by the good witches and powerful wizards like Professor McGonagall. So she did a real very powerful thing in recasting you know, this is new mythology we're looking at in Harry Potter. That's why it was so popular and so powerful. And we have these tremendously positive, learned, older women figures, a few of them, the teachers especially, she being paramount among them. The fairy godmother in Snow White, she has a number of them, seven or some number of fairy, she has a lot of fairy godmothers. But this one is my favorite because in the scene, I don't know if you remember in the Disney movie, in the scene where at the ball, at the end, this one uses her wand to change the color of the dresses. She's like a painter. She can't decide which color she likes better for the party dresses. She keeps changing the color. And that's the grandmother in a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. So they have a transformative quality. McGonagall, some of the other teachers in Harry Potter, certainly fairy godmothers. And there are some good witches in our popular culture, like in The Wizard of Oz, but Glinda's not a... She's not old. She's not old at all. She's young. Are there any... Yeah?
I'm hoping that at some future time when you do this again and add to it, I hope you will have Angelica Houston playing the role of the High Priestess of Avalon. She's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
That's such a positive role.
That's a wonderful suggestion. Remind me after I'm done and I'll write it down so I don't forget. It's a film, yeah? I've actually never seen it.
Made for TV.
Cool.
It looks really good. The Andersen fairy tale picture, like the grandmother must have been a very important character in the story.
Yes, and I don't know which story that pertains to.
All the lines are like zooming to her.
To her, yeah.
Yeah. Her face. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's probably before something horrible happens because the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales are pretty dark. Most of them. So we do also have, of course, in contemporary culture, some wonderful wise old women. This is a very biased. It just happens to be two of my favorites. Linda Hunt on the left, who plays Hetty, the director in NCIS, and she's a wonderful actor, and she's just almost like an elfin character, but very powerful. And super smart and strong and fearless and a woman of tremendous experience.
What film is that? Or what?
It's a TV series, NCIS. There's two offshoots, NCIS LA and NCIS New Orleans. She's in NCIS LA, actually. And she's a fantastic character. Pima Chodron is not a character. She's a real person, of course, a well-known Buddhist. Writing and speaking and teaching, she's means a lot. Her teaching means a lot to a great many people.
Oh, yeah.
Real wisdom there. And now we get to the gorgeous older women, the ones just a sort of a biased collection of some of my favorite actors and a few. I'm an activist and a dancer and a singer thrown in. Of course, there are a lot of extremely beautiful old women out there, or older women, real ones, not just mythical ones, and I admire all of these women. They're all good actors, and Judith Jameson is a dancer who's the director of Alvin Ailey, and of course that's Gloria Steinem at the top, up at the march on Washington the day after the inauguration. And should I go around? Everybody knows who they are, right?
No.
So that's Emma Thompson, and these women are all 60 or over, roughly. Emma may be a touch under 60, I think she's the youngest. Emma Thompson, Gloria Steinem, so we're going clockwise. Meryl Streep, of course, Joan Baez to her right, Vanessa Redgrave below Joan Baez, Cher, who arguably probably has the most work of any of these women. I don't know if there's much of her original cells left, but but she is a kind of amazing, you know, ageless character with a lot of help, or a lot of work, as they say in Hollywood. Judi Dench, Isabelle Huppert, through 63.
Really?
Yeah. We should have gotten Best Actress, McCullough, Judith Jameson, Susan Sarandon, and then, of course, the inimitable Helen Mirren and Charlotte Rampling, wonderful actor.
Rampling.
And it's no coincidence that they're so beautiful, because they started out beautiful, wildly beautiful to begin with. That's why they're, you know, part of their gift as actors. And I think actors also take really good care of themselves. They are taken good care of,
yeah.
And they learn how to do that. And also, their beauty is so much on display that they become very comfortable with that over time, the ones who hang in there.
And iconic.
Yes, absolutely. And they really are our stars, you know. We put them up above us and kind of worship. They are goddesses at this point in our culture. And it's also true that in our species, the females are the ones who carry more of the display, the function of displaying ourselves and being, in quotes, beautiful. But in most other species, it's the male who's more decorated, more decorative, more stands out more, of course, like our very beloved red cardinals who light up our winter times.
Yeah.
But it's not true uniformly. There are rare places on this earth where and this is one of the only indigenous peoples, the Lodabe in Niger, where the men dress up, not every day, but for rituals, for festivals, and there's a particular festival where they make themselves beautiful, and they use the word beauty in their language. For the women, the young women, and the young women are the judges of their dance contest. And it's also a betrothal, courtship ritual. But they decorate themselves and paint themselves up and they're amazing, and they're tall, and there are videos of them you can see. It's just gorgeous. And as things change in our culture, thank goodness, things are changing, very much more gender fluidity, and men are taking on, some men are taking on fantastic displays. This is a drag queen at Mardi Gras. But on the right are our Tenga teachers, who have Claudio on the left and Sid, who dance competitively. And Claudio is the first male to win a major competition dancing the follower's part in heels.
Really?
Yeah, and they're outstanding dancers. And I couldn't get a good photo, but they competed. They did a dance tango demonstration last year in a queer festival in San Francisco. And for that one, Claudio had on short shorts with his high stilettos heels and a white dinner jacket. Pretty fabulous. A lot of display there, and they dance like angels. It's just amazing.
Really? Mm-hmm.
So, for many, many women, this is a famous photograph. Yeah, Ruth Orkin's photograph from 1951, so it's an old one. For many women, being on display is a complicated and complex matter. And we spend our youth finding fault with ourselves and trying to both attract and deflect attention, I think. And then we spend our old age lamenting the loss of what we had or didn't have or didn't think we had or didn't know we had until it was gone. Mm-hmm. And in a recent interview with the woman in the photograph, Nina Lee Craig, who's now 83, she described what was going on there. She said she was traveling alone through Europe on a dollar a day was her budget. She was in Florence. She met Ruth Orkin at a hostel or a cheap hotel, the photographer. They were having a great time. They decided that they were going to hook up, as we would now say, I mean, travel together for a while. And Ruth wanted Nina Lee to just walk around Florence, and she was going to take some pictures. And Nina Lee Craig, now at 83, says, I was having a great time, she said. Those men didn't mean any harm.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not so sure she felt that way at the time, but that's what she thinks looking back. And she was 6'1",
wow.
And that photo in color, that scarf was bright orange. She's absolutely stunning. And she always looked incredibly pained to me, but that's not what she says now. Many older women, and men too, complain that they feel invisible, that people look past you, look through you, and don't notice you at all. But I'm trying to find something of value there in that invisibility. Of course, coming from an arts background, there are many older artists whom I admire tremendously. And older artists are scarcely invisible. But they may help the rest of us to find ways to come to terms with aging and facing death. Mm-hmm. This particular bunch, and I'll tell you who they are in a second, all are making or have made great art right up to and into their the end of their lives. And the focus isn't on them. It's on what they're doing, saying, being, singing, putting out into the world. So I think they really can inspire us as we get older. So that's, of course, David Bowie, Pablo Casals, playing cello, Willem de Kooning, who kept on painting through dementia, possibly even Alzheimer's. The paintings got much simpler, but he just kept on working, and they're kind of amazing. They're very luminous. They're he's a painter I absolutely love. They're not my favorite of his paintings, but they're amazing. Right below him is Walt Whitman.
Oh, yeah.
Gorgeous face. Toni Morrison below him, a writer who I love. Next to her is Merce Cunningham, who kept on dancing until the end of his life. And he was interviewed. There's a wonderful interview with him. He was 90. Somebody asked him, "Oh, you're still dancing? That must be hard." He said, "No, what's hard is getting out of bed." He said, "Once I'm out, dancing is not a problem." Above him is Stanley Kunitz, the poet. And there's so many wonderful older poets I could have put here. I just like his face. And George O'Keefe, of course, to his right. So that's this particular bunch, but I could have...
Who's in the lower...
Oh, Leonard, I'm sorry, Leonard Cohen, of course. And to have lost Leonard Cohen and David Bowie in the same year is amazing. Very sad and wonderful at the same time. Another great hero of mine, an inspiring figure, is the dancer Bill T. Jones. This is a photograph for a dance that he's going to be performing at Mass MoCA in the spring.
Mm.
He's a survivor of AIDS, as well as being a magnificent choreographer and performer, and he has an amazing dance company.
What's his name?
Bill T. Jones, son ninth, eighth or ninth child of a sharecropper, youngest child of a sharecropper. So work by older artists and musicians and dancers and writers isn't necessarily more beautiful, in my view, than that made by younger people. We can't argue that. But because in some cases, at least, the ego has been worn down and kind of polished.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I get that image of transparency or translucency.
Mm-hmm.
There's a greater depth, I think. And this relates to Keats's idea about negative capability. So here, I want to go into that just a little bit. So Keats, who didn't get old at all, he died really young, wrote in his a letter to, he only referred to this once, in this letter to his two brothers. So he wrote, "Several things dovetailed in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, or a woman, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously, I mean negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And then he goes into a little aside about Coleridge, which is so obscure I'm not going to read it, because he thought that Coleridge was an example of somebody who didn't have negative capability because he wrote from a sort of a higher ideal. So
Can you read the quote again?
Yeah. It's not quite over, so I'll read you the whole thing. So several things dovetailed in my mind, and at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement, especially in literature, and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability. That is, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. With a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather obliterates all consideration. And that was written in 1899 to his two brothers. And apparently, so he had in mind Shakespeare, and I think, obviously, it's because of Shakespeare's capacity to enter into so many different points of view and characters, rather than imposing a higher order of truth or an overarching philosophy of being.
Mm. I swear to the exact description of science.
Of science?
That, to be a scientist, that's what you got to do, be comfortable with doubt, uncertainty,
Interesting. That's true. Huh. That's very interesting. I didn't think of that. That's great. Thank you for that. So, I just wanted to bring in a little bit. One could go on for hours with poetry that exemplifies negative capability. So, I just am picking just a couple of stanzas so as not to belabor or become tiresome about this very vague point that I'm trying to make. Wallace Stevens is a poet who I love, a difficult poet, and not a particularly old poet. He was not old when he wrote 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And just fifth stanza, there's 13 short stanzas, each one almost like a haiku, and the fifth stanza is the one quoted there. I do not know which to prefer, the beauty of inflections or the beauty of innuendos, the blackbird whistling or just after. And this also relates to the Buddhist idea of impermanence and being present with what is, with what arises and passes away with each breath. I came across an Emily Dickinson poem today in the new little book of poems that were written on envelopes, just jottings, just notes. They're just little notes for poems. And one of the backs of the envelope said, "One note from one bird is better than a million words." And I'm sure that was before, you know, a picture's worth of 1,000 words saying came into being. Another stanza from Wallace Stevens. It's the last stanza of the poet The Snowman. "For the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there and nothing that is." So that sense of being nothing yourself, being able to come to that, I think age helps with that, of becoming so absorbed in the observation that you lose your self-consciousness finally, and that's a gift. This is also related to, I finally got my dog in there, to the idea from Taoism of Wu Wei. I don't know how you pronounce it properly in Chinese, Wu Wei, non-doing or effortless action, without striving, without control, without effort. It's associated in Taoism with water and its yielding nature.
The path of least resistance.
Yeah. And we get a little better at that as we get older, I think. Another image, a photo I took at the wonderful Storm King Sculpture Park, is an Andy Goldsworthy wall, serpentine wall. He is not old, and he wasn't old when he made this, but I think it's a suitable image for what I'm trying to talk about. So aligning oneself with the natural processes already in play, instead of trying to exert force and will, this idea of Wu Wei.
Yeah.
A quote from the Tao Te Ching: "The sage is occupied with the unspoken and acts without possessing, creating without regard to result, claiming nothing. The sage has nothing to lose." It's also akin to Satori in Zen Buddhism, which is insight into the real, achieved without striving.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a psychoanalyst of the British school, 1950s and 60s and 70s, named Wilfred Bion, who some people may be familiar with. Really an extraordinary man. And he insisted upon remaining in a state of not knowing. And he said each session should be approached without memory or desire, is an important idea of Bion's that's related to this whole negative capability thing, I think. He also believed that the scientific approach was too narrow. He said, you have to be able to have a chance of feeling that the interpretation you give as an analyst is beautiful, is a beautiful one, or that you get a beautiful response from the patient. This aesthetic element of beauty makes a very difficult situation possible. So, as far as I know, I'll come to you in one sec. As far as I know, Bion and Hillman are really the only psychoanalysts who talk about beauty in relation to psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, and I love that. I love them for that. Yeah.
Can you see that art? The first quote on that page, when you were talking about Andy Goldsworthy, there was a line, creating without...
Yeah, the sage, this comes from the Tao Te Ching.
Oh.
The sage is occupied with the unspoken and acts without possessing, creating without regard to result, claiming nothing, the sage has nothing to lose.
What that really brings up for me about Andy Goldsworthy is the work that he did with ice.
Yes.
Or work that he did with sand that was going to get washed away. And he was not attached to the permanence of any of that, but allowed the melting and dissolution to be part of the beauty of
You're
it.
So right.
And that is such a beautiful model for a way to surrender to age.
Yeah, that's so true. I should have, instead of this, I should have had a picture of the icicle piece, one of the icicle pieces. So Andy Goldsworthy, just in case anybody doesn't know about him, he's an English, Welsh, I think, sculptor who worked prior to this work with the stones. All of his work was in the landscape, made with the materials at hand, and they were all transient materials. So he took fall leaves and attached them to the limb of an old tree with thorns that were present there on a rose bush. He made sculpture out of icicles. He glued them together with spit because it was a really cold day, and he reshaped them into a spiral. That's one of my favorite pieces. He made pieces with flower petals, poppy petals, that he put into the pool of a very dark-colored stream in Scotland, near where he was living. He made an incredible mandala with dandelion blossoms and stuff like that. Yes?
The stones are actually transient, too. It'll just take longer.
Thank you. Absolutely so. And I think they were on site. Anyway, he incorporated stones on site into those walls that he made. And, you're absolutely right.
Where was that?
It's at Storm King.
Where's that?
Storm King is outdoor sculpture park. Absolutely sensational. It's west of the Hudson, south of Beacon a little bit. So it's about an hour and a half, an hour from New York City. It's probably 2 hours from here. You go down the New York Thruway, and it's easy to find.
Thank you.
Very much worth a trip in the little bit one more level.
Is this called Storm King?
Storm King.
Storm King?
Yeah.
I think there's a sculpture garden there.
It's outdoor sculpture. That's what it is. So there are many sculptures situated beautifully in the landscape. They're contemporary. There's nothing older than maybe 1950s. So, contemporary, spanning the last 100 years. Or, not 100 years, but almost. Oh, so, just coming back again to archetypal psychology and joining that together with this wonderful poem by Stan McKunitz, whose face was in the previous slide. The artist Philip Guston, who I admire very much, who was an abstract expressionist who ended up drawing and painting these extremely weird cartoon-like things, he did some drawings incorporating poems, and this is by Stan McKunitz, called King of the River. And I think it relates to Hillman's idea about pathologizing, which I'll explain in a moment. So this poem says, "A dry fire eats you, fat drips from your bones, the flutes of your gills discolor, you've become a ship for parasites. The great clock of your life is slowing down, and the small clocks run wild. I did not choose the way chose me." So that's again that Wu Wei idea. And in archetypal psychology, Hillman and other archetypal psychologists make a point about the psyche's innate tendency and orientation towards suffering, morbidity, an afflicted underworld perspective, an orientation toward the underworld and death and shadow, which is deepened and informed by age, by aging, and which, of course, brings with it an awareness of death. Hillman wrote, this is Hillman, quoting Hillman, his definition of pathologizing, a word that he coined. "The psyche's autonomous ability to create illness, morbidity, disorder, abnormality, and suffering in any aspect of its behavior, and to experience and imagine life through this deformed and afflicted perspective." That's from a Revisioning Psychology, a great book of his. And that's true of the psyche when it comes, as it comes through us in dreams of when we're at any age. It's not just pertaining to aging, but I think aging brings our ego into a more pathologized state, which in the language of archetypal and Jungian psychology means more soulful. We get more soulful, we get more connected to the psyche or soul.
Need to hear a little more about that.
Yeah, me too.
What was the context, and can you repeat the...
I just, when I saw that drawing,
yeah,
I thought of Hillman's archetypal psychology's idea about pathologizing. Because it's really a great poem about age and aging and old age, but it also really fits that idea about pathologizing, which gets conveniently left out, I have to say, by a lot of Jungians, and a lot of new age, the whole new age psychology movement is always about improvement.
Yeah.
Everything gets better. Mm-hmm. Even when you're old, you get more whole, you know. In Jungian psychology, the self is manifesting through you. It's better and better, which is also bullshit, you know. Because things, as Yeats said, things fall apart, right? The center cannot hold. And that's pathologizing. And that shows up in dreams constantly. You know, nightmares are not just the product of our traumas, they're also some innate predilection of the psyche, I think, for twisted, morbid, horrible images. And I think that shows up also in our, in popular culture, in our fascination with horror. You know, which is, and killing, which is so ubiquitous in films and in television. So there's something in the soul that, you know, wants that, gravitates.
And it's not just about aging.
It's not just about aging. Yes, except aging really brings it on. Like, we can ignore it, and we want to ignore that, but finally we can't. Yeah. So sooner or later, if we get to become old, we get to have that and deal with it. But it's there all along. That's the point of archetypal psychology.
So, one of the things I got, you know, you're talking about this as you get older. I mean, as we get older, we become more particular, more peculiar,
yeah,
more complex. And one of the things that struck me at the beginning of your talk, you're showing this ideal of beauty in women, and it's this youthful thing.
Right.
And yet, there's a certain oriented to that, but it's also almost like a baby. You know, this ideal of youthful woman is almost empty. It's not formed yet.
Yeah.
It's generic.
Yes.
It's not. Wow, like Judi Dench, someone
yeah.
particular and intricate, and I don't know which is more beautiful.
But would you have said that 30 years ago? Would you have seen it?
I think so. When you were showing the movie stars when I was 7 or 8,
mm-hmm.
my big crush was Linda Jackson as Queen Elizabeth.
Wow. Very cool.
Where did I go?
And if we go back, let me just click back to Bill T. Jones. I saw him dance, it was about 10, 15 years ago, at Massmoke, actually. He did an old piece from his early days of his company, and they danced in the nude. It was, from the 60s, late 60s, I think, early 70s. Right? So there he is. They're doing this dance again, and in the, somewhere in the early 21st century when he is already in his 50s. And the company are all in their early 20s. I don't think any of them were over 25. Mm. Gorgeous dancers. And his body was so remarkable to see this older man in the context of these young dancers, all of them naked, you really could see it. And the articulation in his muscles. Mm. It's like the wisdom was visible in his muscles. It was unbelievable. Mm. Really beautiful. Mm. So, where are we for time?
Just after.
Oh. Okay. So, I have this idea. I mean, we don't have to do this. It's a little experiential component. We could just do discussion and questions instead. But let me show you what I have in mind. I have to go forward. So here's the exercise. to ask yourself, what's the most beautiful thing you've seen, heard, or experienced in the past week or in the recent past? And to ask yourself how your sense of beauty has changed and developed over time, if you think it has. And then, if you like, to exchange, to talk a little bit with your neighbor about that. I mean, we could spend 10 minutes doing that, or you could just take it home with you. What's everybody's sense? What?
Yeah, let's do the...
Want to do it?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Cool, okay. So, I'm going to give you a few moments just to think, just to imagine. And you can do this by yourself. You don't have to talk with your neighbor about it. But let's spend a few moments just contemplating it. And the first part, and so I'll give you like a minute to think about the first part, and then a minute to think about the second part. And then you'll feel free to share with each other. Okay, so first part. It might be nice to close your eyes. What's the most beautiful thing you have seen, heard, or experienced in the past week or in the recent past?
You want us to say it out loud?
No,
or
no. I want you to just think it. And then you're going to think about the next part, and then you're going to share. And maybe it doesn't have to be just one thing. Several things probably will come. Okay. Now you can add to that. Think about how your sense of beauty, your perceptions of beauty, have perhaps changed and developed over time. So are there things you find beautiful now that you didn't find beautiful before? Or things that you used to find beautiful that you don't find beautiful now, but you find something else beautiful instead. So I'm going to give you about a minute to think about that. And then maybe instead of talking amongst neighbors,
yeah,
let's share with each other.
Yeah.
I think that might be more fun. And do we need a microphone to pass around, or can we just holler?
We can usually hear each other in here.
Okay.
So share with our neighbors.
So, no, share. Really. Let's share with everybody. So who's got something? Yeah.
I was walking the other morning, and I saw some small silver dots against a blue sky, and I wondered, what is that? So I walk, and I see that it's a giant pussy willow, and the pussy willows are just coming out, and the sky is pristine blue, and a turkey vulture comes overhead, and there's a burbling stream, and I stopped. It stopped my mind. I wept, and I later thought, you know, it was beautiful, but it was really the quality of my own awareness, because any other day, maybe I wouldn't have noticed that.
Uh-huh, it really stopped you.
Oh, yes. I mean, I was completely awash with tears.
Huh.
Of joy. It was the simplest thing.
So that's a quality, that's a wonderful description, and it points to something really important, which is that beauty arrests us, you know, in not always, but it can. It has that power. And also the word inspiration comes from the that you get sometimes in a moment like this. So it brings you in right into the present. Yeah.
I wanted to share two things. One is that just your request that we think about something beautiful.
Yeah.
Just sitting, before I even came up with anything, just sitting and letting my mind move toward that question,
mm-hmm,
was so delightful. It was just a delightful suggestion and experience.
Oh, I'm glad.
Just waiting for the, you know, scanning for beauty. But what came to me was, actually, I was at the post office in Northampton the other day, and there was a young woman, she must have been in her early 20s, all kind of, for lack of better descriptive words, pumped out, you know, pierced and pumped out, carrying this huge box of envelopes, all identical stuff with something. And I was bored, so I just said to her, wow, looks like you have a big project. And she ended up telling me, after I asked a few questions, that she had stuffed all these envelopes of T-shirts she had made for women in domestic violence shelters.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why? And she said, with all that's going on in the world right now, she just felt she had to do something.
Wow.
And I just, you know, I nearly cried. I felt so moved.
Huh.
By this young woman just taking this on herself. And this was a huge,
huh,
I don't know, there must have been 50-100 envelopes in there. It was so beautiful.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
Because you didn't even see the T-shirt.
No.
It was just the action. It was the action.
Moment. It was just that she did that.
It was the gesture.
She,
yeah.
She
the feeling.
I had to pull it out.
Yeah. Huh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The most beautiful thing you've seen or experienced the past week, I saw a film, the Multicultural Film Festival at UMass, and a woman, the director was there, and she filmed her grandfather. The name of the film was 95 and Six to Go. So the last, off and on, the last few years of her grandfather's life, it was Japanese American growing up in Hawaii, and worked in a post office all his life. And it, and she's biracial, but she was so sensitive. She just had the film. He's retired, just puttering around his house, and he lost his wife, and he missed his wife, and he was lonely. And then the film showed these black and white photographs when he was younger, when he loved to dance. And what came up for me, and I mentioned it in the feedback, it reminded me, my dad died when he was 95 years old, and before he died, a few years before he died, I sat down with him, and I videotaped for hours. What was your life before you met Mom? What was your parents' life when they were children? What was your, you have 10 brothers and sisters, what was your life on the farm? And I asked all these questions, and he told me these incredible stories, and it touched me seeing this film. And at the end of the film, he dies and he's cremated, and they show his burial in the Buddhist ceremony or something. And it was just so sensitive, because she didn't really interject in the film. She just filmed it. And then every so often, you saw these gorgeous scenes of these huge waves hitting the rocks in Hawaii, these beautiful waves and people surfing, and beautiful nature. And you just saw this, I don't know, it just touched me. It's so beautiful that old age and nature kind of,
coming together.
And death kind of came together.
There's another wonderful film about an old lady it makes me think of called Nine Good Teeth. You can get it on Netflix. It's a documentary about somebody's Sicilian grandmother in the suburbs of New Jersey. And it's also, she's, you know, she just, there's one scene where he comes in and he follows her around, just wantonly, and he follows her into the bathroom, and he says, "How many teeth you got, Grandma? How many teeth you got left?" She looks in the mirror and she says, "I got 9 good teeth." That's also quite beautiful.
It's where the film, he looks at the granddaughter and says, "When you get a job, you waste your life. You're not working because you're just trying to make a film, you know." And he was just totally blunt. "When you get a job, you're wasting your life." Anyway, thanks for the
suggestion. Yeah.
I have a 6-year-old female cat who's the lady of the house. And then a couple of years ago, I got a male kitten. They're both part Maine Coon, and he's been trying to dominate her for 2 years, of course. And she was holding her own beautifully, and she got sick this last year. She sort of got frail and sort of lost her place. And yesterday they were both on the windowsill, and he started cat batting, you know, put up his paw, and she just went, and just this fire in her, and he just went, "All right," and backed off. And it was just startling and beautiful seeing her, you know, take charge and say, "Wait a minute, she's back."
Did anybody have something come to them that wasn't visual?
Music. Yeah.
Food. Nice. Yeah.
And the second part of that, something has changed over time, which I've noticed that over a long, long period of time, which reminds me of your comment about, you know, the young people in the picture look kind of generic, but as the older people look more kind of specific and complex. And I'm a pianist, and my experience of playing music has really, really changed over time. Whereas as a younger performer, I'm playing the piece. And now it's like, oh my God, this piece is blowing my mind.
That's a great
example. And my heart and you know, my body.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
Even if technically, do you feel technically that you're better, worse, same?
No, I'm actually improved and changed, and that's been part of the shift of perspective.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
In my case, I experienced contact improvisation dancing.
I've done that too.
That was was one of my highlights.
As a form of beauty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a form of what I enjoy the most.
Mm-hmm.
In a transcendent kind of way.
Does everybody know what it is? Mm-hmm. It's a totally improvisational dance form where the continuity is physical contact and exchange of weight. And something that strikes me about contact, having done it, is that the experience of doing it is beautiful. Looking at it as a spectator, yes, but not so much, not that much. I found more beauty in the experience of it than in the watching of it. Yeah.
I think this might be fun to share. I also play the piano, and I also suffer in front of this set of teeth, 88 notes long, when I was younger. And then gave it a rest for a while. And now when I play the piano, it's not like I'm playing or separate from the piano. It's like I and the piano and the music are all one symbiotic process. And time is suspended. And this really reminds me of something that Sue Monk Kidd wrote in her book Traveling with Pomegranates, which was autobiographical. She wrote part of it and her daughter wrote part of it when they were visiting the Temple of Dendur in Eleusis. And Sue Monk Kidd was really suffering with what a friend of mine called a mortality check. She was becoming aware of her mortality. She wasn't happy about it. She was trying to figure out how to live with it. And finally, at one point in this book that is still resounding for me, she says, the way to not be restricted by time is to live so, to be so present in the moment that that moment becomes eternal.
Wow, that's it.
Yeah, I think that's key.
That's so important, and I think I could have actually spoken to that, should have spoken to that, because that's such a key part, actually, of what I was talking about, is experience of being able to concentrate, to be absorbed utterly in something, in such a way that time alters or stops.
Those moments of beauty that surprise you, that
they take you out of.
People mentioned they do. They take you out of being stuck in time.
Yes.
You just expand and you can be limitless.
Yes, that's so true. Thank you.
Yeah, and that made me work for that Kairos.
Yeah. In the back, yes.
I'm thinking about what you said about experience, and I'm wondering if beauty is not out there, but it's something here. There's only things out there, whatever they may be, it could be almost random. It's that which elicits love inside of us.
Some things are darn ugly, too.
But the thing about that, and that there's no way that that's not true, but in the tradition of archetypal psychology, there is soul in the world, in things, in inanimate things, even in the air conditioner, right? So that, because if we go too much into the idea that that it's in us as the perceiver, it aggrandizes us too much, I think, as a species, and we're too grandiose as a species. I think we need to be dialed way back in that regard, so that we, you know, we begin to really appreciate the beauty in things and in places,
and
in, you know, inherent beauty.
I guess I'm not thinking of it so much as being inside, but the experience.
It's true. I mean, we are the species who has that capacity. That's the other thing about us. You know, we can perceive beauty and know that we're perceiving it. We think. Anyway, we're unique in that, and it's a remarkable capacity, you're right. Way in the back.
So, an encounter of beauty this week was that I watched a film called Whale Dreamers, and a lot of it was very disturbing. It was about indigenous people, a particular indigenous tribe in Australia, who commune with whales. They do these active rituals at the ocean, and they do dances specifically to call for the whales. And they just like exchange energy with them, and they also have specific dreams. It's an ancient tradition of their tribe that they dream of the whale and things happen and they interact.
Yeah.
And so because of tourism and whaling and all these things, the film is a lot about how their way of life has been, you know,
degraded,
really destroyed, not just impacted, but destroyed.
Yeah.
And so the beauty that was just beyond, I mean, I was absolutely weeping over it, was at one point a new tourist structure along the ocean had been set up so tourists could come and do whale watching, and the tribe was coming down to actually perform a ceremony at this sacred site. They didn't know that that was there, that new structure. So they were, and the film crew was getting all this, you know, they were devastated. So they went, and then they were told, you can't, by whatever civil officials, you can't do this ceremony anymore. So they snuck off, the whole crew and the tribe and everyone snuck off and went to another site. And so, and this was the moment I was like, my breath was taken away, and I was like, God, so extraordinary, like, beautiful, and I was crying. They started doing their ritual dance, and someone was, one of the elders was doing a voiceover talking about what they were doing and how they were calling to the whale. And the idea that these, why it struck me this way, but these adults, very serious people, and their whole beings were so intent on communing with these whales, which in our culture, of course, it would be, you know, flaky blow or whatever. And then the whale, one of the whales came. I mean, it was such a thing of tremendous beauty to witness their ritual, but then the interaction, and, you know. And then further, they had a like a global conference, and they called indigenous leaders from all over the world, and there was one elder who came from the Pacific Northwest tribe, and her people had stopped whaling like decades ago, and now they were deciding to start to whale again, whereas she was having dreams of the whales saying, don't let this happen, you know, we've begun to trust you, and please try to protect us. And they showed her talking about it and weeping, and that was also just incredibly beautiful.
Amazing.
She was so devoted to their protection.
Well, thank you all for sharing these wonderful moments, and I think it's a very important, it counteracts in a powerful way what we're suffering from witnessing every day now, which is such an increase in ugliness on every level, you know, in our government, and being perpetrated with the threat of more every day, you know. And so I just want to encourage everybody to do this, take it seriously. We need more attention to beauty, to discovering and experiencing beauty. Thank you so much.